Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
So, it's come to this. A company that has better than 90% market share in its core business can't get by anymore. Microsoft announced its first ever mass layoffs today, which probably doesn't mean good things for the rest of the economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is the 22nd of January, today, Thursday. Good to have you here, as always. If we could flip back the calendar a couple of months, this recession would look pretty different than it does right now. We got by for a year, thinking the economic distress was limited to housing and, more recently, big banks. News today wipes that theory clear off the map and leaves no doubt that bad mortgages have caused problems in just about every corner of the U.S. economy. Marketplace's John Dimsdale tells us that earnings reports today from the bluest of the blue chips, supposedly stable, reliable, and rock-solid companies, are showing the effects.
Applications for government jobless benefits surged in today's weekly report to levels not seen since the early 1980s. Microsoft will be adding to the unemployment lines, announcing 5,000 layoffs today. Chipmaker Intel said it will close factories and get rid of more workers. And Sony reported its first annual loss in 14 years. The Japanese electronics maker is in the process of cutting 16,000 jobs.
This unemployment is very egalitarian.
Economic forecaster Jack Albertine says highly educated workers used to be recession-proof.
In this recession, we're seeing, of course, unskilled workers being laid off, but we're also seeing hotshot MBAs from Harvard and Princeton and Yale all through the financial sector and in the high-tech sector laid off.
Big, stable technology companies are being hit harder in this economy than they were when the high-tech bubble burst 9 years ago, says S&P chief economist David Weiss.
As you get mature, your growth isn't as good. It's a little harder to shrug off a weak economy. Plus, let's face it, this is a much weaker economy than we were looking at in 2001. 2001 was barely a recession. This one could be the worst recession since the 30s.
Weiss says it's hard to gain a toehold when consumer spending is falling off a cliff. The big blue-chip company General Electric reports earnings tomorrow. Analysts fear any profit will be due to tax write-offs rather than real growth. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Earnings reports are tricky to parse even in the best of times. Forget about when everybody's feeling stressed. And Google is today's case in point. The search engine that would rule the world reported better than expected profits today, but expectations were pretty low. In fact, today is the first time that Google's profits actually fell from a year earlier. Still made money, just not as much. Today, the Commerce Department reported the number of people filing for first-time unemployment benefits rose to a 26-year high. That's 589,000 new people signing up for state assistance, either online or in person, in just a single week. Layoffs don't affect those who lose their jobs alone, though. From Portland, Oregon, Sadie Babbitts has this story about the ripple effects of so many people being out of work.
David Bunker has had a string of bad luck lately. Last October, he lost his job as a sales manager at a title insurance company in Portland. This week, on his way to a job fair, he got rear-ended. His car was totaled.
Being unemployed, it's opened up a whole, set of challenges that I haven't faced before.
Finding full-time work has become a full-time job, and Bunker is competing with some 174,000 other unemployed Oregonians.
I mean, I've been through quite a few recessions, and I've never experienced this many professional people out of work.
At 44, David Bunker is tightening his belt. He and his wife have cut the extras out of the household budget. Gym membership, gone. Vacations, postponed. Cell phone service, reduced.
Really keeping an eye on the gas I'm spending, driving around, renegotiating terms on credit cards and or loans that I have.
And he's nixed one of his favorite things, going out for sushi.
definitely sushi is out of the question now because it's an expensive item.
Restaurants are feeling the ripple effect of the David Bunkers of the world who are now eating at home. This is Mio Sushi in Portland's Hollywood District. Jay Park is a waiter here. He says regulars aren't coming in.
Customers that usually come twice a week, now they started coming like once a week. Sometimes they don't come at all.
Mio Sushi hasn't laid anyone off yet, but according to Oregon State Economist, when someone like David Bunker loses his job, there's usually at least one other person who also gets laid off. We find those people in a visit to a regional employment office.
I know how I want to have you know.
The place is packed just minutes after the doors open. Amy Vandervliet is the regional economist here. She says the latest state unemployment rate, 9% for December, is the highest rate since the mid-1980s.
And the unemployment rate tends to be a lagging indicator, so we're in for more or higher unemployment in the months to come because I don't think we've hit bottom yet.
In fact, computer chip maker Intel announced this week it's closing a plant in suburban Portland. Another 1,000 people will be looking for work. For Marketplace, I'm Sadie Babbitts in Portland.
Add former Merrill Lynch CEO John Thain to the list of the unemployed. Thain resigned today after a 15-minute meeting with his new boss, Bank of America CEO Ken Lewis. It's anybody's guess as to the immediate cause for what amounts to a dismissal. Maybe it was the billions in Merrill losses that nobody knew about until the acquisition of B of A was about to close. Or maybe it was the news today that Thain moved up Merrill's bonuses to get them handed out before the B of A deal was done. Today was another nervous day for the British pound on the foreign exchange markets. Sterling has been hammered this week as foreign investors fret over the state of the UK's banks. Of course, our banking system is hardly in great shape. And yet the greenback is still riding high. From London Marketplace's Stephen Beard has this tale of two currencies.
This week, the British pound fell to a 23-year low against the US dollar. Neil McKinnon, who's with the ECU Currency Group, says dealers have been gripped by an extraordinary fear.
That Britain might be going bust, that Britain's sovereign credit rating might actually be downgraded because of the cost of the bank bailouts, the impact on Britain's debt level.
The British government is now backing the UK's troubled banks to the hilt. One of them alone, the Royal Bank of Scotland, has liabilities almost double the size of the whole UK economy. By comparison, the US government is much less exposed, says Paul Ashford of Capital Economics.
I mean, we have had, even recently, bailouts of Citigroup and Bank of America, but so far, up to now, the federal government hasn't been forced to commit the same sorts of sums.
He says that's why the dollar is doing better than the pound. Also, the greenback is still the world's number one reserve currency. In the midst of the crisis that it created, the US remains a safe haven. And much safer than Britain, says Ian Marsh of the Cass Business School in London.
While it's got huge problems, it's got more depth to it, and therefore at the moment it's not suffering so badly. That's not to say it won't if continuing bad news keeps emerging from Wall Street and Main Street America.
For now, however, the pound is taking the heat, and some dealers even predict it could hit parity with the US dollar. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
It was up, down, and all around today on Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Not even a day old, but the ban on lobbyists working in President Obama's administration has already run into trouble. William Lynn, the president's pick to be number two at the Pentagon, was a lobbyist for the defense contractor Raytheon until this past July. Word out of the White House is that Lynn is going to be getting a waiver of some kind. Despite the new rules that the president announced yesterday, with an $850 billion stimulus package working its way through Congress, one might think Washington's lobbying industry is booming. At $850 billion, there's plenty of room in that package to get something for everybody, right? But Marketplace's Steve Henn reports the bad economy even has some on K Street feeling anxious.
Right now, more than $250 billion in tax cuts are sandwiched into President Obama's economic plan. John Raffaelli is a Democratic tax lobbyist. Most of his clients want something included in that bill or something taken out.
The biggest difference this year is that you know that what's being considered is actually going to get signed into law. So you've really got to take, you got to realize it's for real, it's serious.
That means Raffaelli's practice is booming. But he says that's not unusual when a new administration comes to town.
Anytime there's turnover, whether from Democrat to Republican, Republican to Democrat, it's going to create a lot of lobbying activity.
You might be in one of the few industries in America right now that is looking up.
Well,
Washington's lobbying industry is supposed to be recession-proof, but some K Street insiders are nervous.
There's definitely some fear out here this time.
Stephen Hart is a prominent Republican lobbyist, but it's not his party affiliation or Obama's new lobbying restrictions that have him worried. It's the economy.
I think we may be in an economic downturn that's perhaps worse than anything we've seen since the 30s. And that is going to impact the amount of money that's spent in Washington, D.C. A sophisticated business leader is going to have to make the decision about whether he's going to turn the lights on in his factory or have his lobbyists go to the Hill.
Some trade associations and corporate government affairs shops are already seeing cutbacks. It's true, new leaders bring new ideas, and that usually brings in the business. But this year may be different. This year, Hart says, many businesses that need lobbyists simply may not have the money to pay for them. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
There's a report out from Standard & Poor's today that bears some notice. Not so much for what it says, that companies are having a hard time paying their debts, although they are, and in record numbers this year. S&P says 14% of American companies are going to default on their loans in 2009. The more interesting thing, really, is what those defaults are going to mean for the rest of the economy. Standard & Poor's Diane Vaza did the research. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Let's make sure we understand what exactly this report's about. Corporate default is another way of saying these companies aren't paying their debts.
That's right. They're not paying their debts.
Why is that? I mean, empirically, we sort of know the economy's bad, but why is it specifically happening at such a great rate?
Well, it's happening at such a great rate because we've had a sharp contraction in the U.S. economy. And when that happens, companies, their sales drop off and their profits get squeezed and they can't pay, the interest to service their debts.
How bad is it? I mean, can you quantify it for us?
Sure. Last year in the U.S., we had just over 90 companies that defaulted. This year, our expectation is that there'll be over 200 that could potentially default in the U.S.
So what happens to these companies that are defaulting on their corporate debt now if the economy stays lousy for another 6 months or a year?
Well, some of these companies may be able to restructure their debt. They might be able to go to the holders of their debt and negotiate more favorable terms that will get them through this period. And some companies, in the case of like a Circuit City or, a Linens and Things, may just go completely out of business and completely liquidate.
Is there a vicious cycle here in that these companies who can't pay their debt eventually go bankrupt or stop buying new products, then the suppliers of those products have problems and the people who make the raw materials for those products have problems and it gets ever worse?
That's right. It affects the entire supply chain, and we saw that very clearly with the automotives. We saw that fan out to all the automotive suppliers. It's like an onion, and the layers of the onion get larger and larger as it affects the entire supply chain.
All right, well then play this out for me, because if that onion keeps on getting peeled, what does it say about the eventual pace of a recovery?
Recovery is clearly going to be slow. So although, our current forecast is to look at the economy bottoming mid-year, it's not going to feel particularly good in the second half of the year either. There's not an immediate bounce back. This will be the longest recession we've had in, post-war history. We're expecting it's going to be 18 months.
Is there a way to break the vicious cycle that I talked about earlier, that is companies not paying their debt and getting in more trouble and not being able to pay other debts and so getting in more trouble?
Well, really the only way to break the circle that you're describing is for, the economy to stabilize. And that would be housing, and that would be a return of confidence in the financial sector. And until that happens, that circle may slow, but, At this point, we're in the epicenter of that circle.
Diane Vaza, the head of global fixed income research at Standard & Poor's, out today with a report on corporations not being able to pay their debts in record numbers in the coming year. Diane, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, saving cash by conserving energy.
The more money that we can save on our side is more money we can make available to the teachers in the classroom. And right now, given all the pressures that K-12 is facing, you know, it's critical that we do that.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials were down 105 points today, 1.25%, closed at 8,122. The NASDAQ slipped 41 points, 2.75%, settled at 1465. The S&P 500 retreated 12 points, 1.5%, wrapped up at 840. Weak earnings reports and big projected losses fueled the slide in tech stocks. Microsoft, the one we talked about earlier, gave up close to 12% today. Nokia surrendered more than 10%. Sony purged 14% today. The one bright spot, Apple, rose 6.75% today after exceeding profit forecasts yesterday. Bank stocks took a beating today. Citigroup withdrew 15%. Bank of America lost 14.5%. Midwest powerhouse Fifth Third Bancorp retreated 28.5% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com. Want more from Marketplace's special Fallout coverage? It's all on our website. You'll find special podcasts, videos, and the Marketplace Decoder, a special guide to financial terms and products. Go to marketplace.org.
Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. President Obama is scheduled to meet with congressional leaders to discuss the much-discussed stimulus package. 32 years ago, on January 23rd, the television miniseries Roots began broadcasting. And on January 23rd, 1964, the 24th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution was ratified. It eliminated the poll tax in federal elections. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Like so many presidents before him, Barack Obama has talked a lot about the importance of education. He's talked about the need for arts in schools, the need for teacher training, too. Good ideas, but ones that cost money, money that we're in short supply of these days. Harvard researcher Susan Eaton's most recent book is called The Children in Room E4, American Education on Trial. We got her on the line to talk about education, the Obama administration, and the economy, too. Susan, welcome to the program.
Hi, great to be here.
You, in the course of writing your book, spent a lot of time in and out of public school classrooms in the United States. What's your take on the biggest problems that are out there?
Well, I think that the biggest problem is the fact that huge shares of our children in the United States, disproportionately children of color, Latino and African American children, are simply not connected to mainstream opportunities. And our schools are really have not, at least in the last 8 years or so, and probably even more than that, been trying to connect them to those opportunities.
But it does, in a lot of measures, come down to money, doesn't it?
Yes, and absolutely. And I think a lot of things that would go a very far way in helping children who aren't connected to opportunity be connected would absolutely cost quite a bit of money and would require us to make some choices about what our priorities are. And one of those things is certainly preschool. However, it's also shown by studies by economists, not just by educators, but by economists, that there's huge payoff over the long run. But there's also things that schools can do, the policies that can be changed and reoriented that wouldn't cost an enormous amount of more money.
What might some of those be then?
Over the last 8 years, it seems to me that public schools, especially schools that enroll disproportionate shares of children of color, have become more exclusionary and less inclusive. And one example is through what's often referred to as zero tolerance discipline policies. And these are policies that rely heavily on suspending and expelling kids for what are often minor infractions. And what has been shown time and time again by research is that these policies of suspension and expulsion lead directly to dropping out, and then dropping out is quite directly related to incarceration. I think that this is one thing that we could look at that would be very easy to find alternatives to suspension and expulsion. And then secondly, if you look at the curriculum in public schools, kids in poor schools are far less likely to receive civics education. They're far less likely to engage in the types of activities that would help them prepare for democratic decision making and for being citizens and for being full participants in a democracy. And that, I think, is pretty telling when you look at public schools as a whole. And that's something that we could certainly work on and work towards. And that does not cost very much money.
Do you worry that the debate over public education in this country at the highest levels is going to be circumscribed because of the financial crisis and the state of the economy? I mean, if there's not money to do some of these things, how disheartening is it to talk about them?
No, I don't. I think that the discourse is going to improve. And with education, money has always been tight. That's not a surprise. Even with President Obama, nobody expects the spigots to start flowing for education, especially education for poor kids. Yes, there will be less money and there will need to be cutbacks, and that will affect neighborhoods of concentrated disadvantage and the schools that enroll kids from those neighborhoods far more profoundly than any other neighborhood. But I do see the rhetoric shifting, and I do see people within public education, teachers, administrators, students, feeling a lot more hopeful. And again, not all of these things require money. In some respects, they require a reorientation.
Susan Eaton's the research director at the Charles Hamilton Houston Institute for Race and Justice at Harvard Law School. Her book about public education in urban environments is called The Children in Room E4. Susan, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you so much.
Environmental officials at the United Nations said today they're hoping for an upside out of the global economic downturn, more spending on environmentally friendly projects. South Korea and Japan have already added green to their stimulus packages. The plan Congress is considering includes a chunk of money for the same, including about $25 billion for energy efficiency. Could pay big dividends, but it's not the sexiest line item in the world, things like retrofitting federal buildings and insulating houses. And a lot of that stimulus money could go to companies that have quietly been pushing energy efficiency for years. KUOW's Deborah Wong reports now from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
So watch your step when you come up here.
The attic of Wellington Elementary School is not a place that most people here ever see, but this is where a sophisticated system of ducts and fans and heaters keeps the school warm.
So these go into each of the rooms.
Building custodian Jim Atwood says in the old days, the school in Woodinville, Washington, had a terrible heating system that made hothouses out of some classrooms and left others cold. They were called squirrel cages.
They do sound like squirrel cages, and they oftentimes they'll start making noises and hissing and howling and whatnot.
The new system regulates the temperature evenly and cuts the noise dramatically. But the biggest selling point is the school has slashed its energy use by about 10%. That saves about $26,000 a year, which buys a lot of needed school supplies. Evan Yuji is director of capital projects for the school district.
The more money that we can save on our side is more money we can make available to the teachers in the classroom. And right now, given all the pressures that K-12 is facing, you know, it's critical that we do that.
McKinstry Company installed the system. The Seattle firm specializes in big construction projects, but years ago they started marketing themselves as energy efficiency experts to ride out building downturns. They would retrofit old buildings and make them more energy efficient. Ash Awad is vice president of energy services for McKinstry. He says it was initially kind of a hard sell.
In the early days, we had to get out there and beat the street. We had to talk to a number of folks and try to get them to embrace this idea of making their buildings very energy efficient. You know, keeping in mind that in Washington State, we experienced some of the lowest utility costs in the nation.
But now energy prices are higher and efficiency has become all the rage. Experts argue the U.S. could cut energy use by 20% simply with existing technology. Consumers are looking for a way to save money, businesses are trying to cut costs, and worries about global warming are increasing. A host of companies, including multinationals like Honeywell and Siemens, now upgrade heating, lighting, and air conditioning systems and weatherize buildings. And the industry has a powerful new ally in Washington.
Hello, everybody. Hey, how are you?
During the presidential campaign, Barack Obama toured McKinstry's headquarters, met with workers, and even played basketball in the company gym.
Well, you know, if this president thing doesn't work out, I may come work here.
Then, in his half-hour campaign infomercial, Obama singled out McKinstry.
Recently, I visited the McKinstry Company in Seattle. They're retrofitting schools and office buildings to make them energy efficient. As president, I'll use companies like McKinstry as a model for the nation.
The House stimulus plan sets aside more than $25 billion for energy efficiency projects. Stan Price is executive director of the Northwest Energy Efficiency Council. He says the plan could be an enormous commercial boost.
Particularly with credit markets the way they are, it's more and more difficult for property owners to be able to make that investment right now. So these federal stimulus funds are coming at a really appropriate time.
But that could also lead to an embarrassment of riches. Price worries there aren't enough workers to do all that work. In Seattle, I'm Deborah Wong for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, the political fortunes of Caroline Kennedy appear to have come to an economic end. Kennedy took herself out of the running to replace new Secretary of State Hillary Clinton as the junior senator from New York last night. At the time, it was said to have been for personal reasons. Today, the New York Times sheds a little light. The paper, quoting a source close to New York Governor David Paterson, said Kennedy has problems involving taxes and a household employee. In a not entirely unrelated bit of news, today the Senate Finance Committee endorsed Timothy Geithner to be the next Secretary of the Treasury. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Thursday afternoon. Today, the Dow dropped 105 points, 1.25%. The Nasdaq down 41 points, 2.75%. The S&P 500 fell 12 points, 1.5%. Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, scaling back on celebrations.
The only way to have a wedding that would surpass the bar bat mitzvah is to do it in outer space.
Oi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.